This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, we're going to meet Faye Olubudun, who is the CEO of Insights Publicis in Nigeria. Mubs, you know I'm fascinated with Nigeria. I'm fascinated with the fact that this country has become the leading economy in Africa. And I'm more interested in how we as Africans consume brands. Because I think, and he's written a book, by the way, called The Villager, How Africans Consume Brands. I think we do things differently to the way people in the rest of the world do things. We buy different stuff. We have different patterns of behavior when it comes to buying. In South Africa, I think we're very different to some of the other countries. And I'd like to compare South Africa and Nigeria. And he does that in the book. He also compares Nigeria, South Africa, and Kenya in terms of masculinity, long-term orientation, indulgence, individualism, uncertainty avoidance. I mean, these sound like very, very interesting comparisons and the kind of stuff that will make you smart when it comes to understanding the economy of not only the African continent, but the way that we behave with respect to the other parts of the world and the things in the international economy that make us tick.
I mean, it sounds interesting because it also will teach us, you know, one or two things that we didn't know about parts of the continent.
So absolutely. So welcome to the studio, Faye Olubudun. How are you, sir?
Very fine, thank you. Thank
nice
you
nice to meet you, and congratulations on this book.
Thank you.
It must have been the result of a lot of research.
Yeah, it's a result of years of cumulative 15 years of working, 5 years of speaking and presenting this framework across the world, and one long year of writing.
Well, I mean, it's you do really give people a lot of insight here into how things are done differently. What would you say are the most startling discoveries that you've made with respect to the way that we in Africa consume brands?
I think it's the fact that how amazing it is that some of the smaller nuances that drive consumption is way beyond functional stuff. I remember a couple of experiences. There's one that was quite striking when I was trying to launch a product for a client years ago, and I was on the research end, and you know, three formulations, we did the product test, and everyone said that that the three products were good from a particular part of the country, and I was confused because I'd never seen this before. Like, I knew that the three formulations were different, and we knew the ones that we really wanted to push forward. It was when I recalled that in that particular tribe, they're so diplomatic, they never say anything negative.
So they only say positive things.
They
about
only say positive things.
Brands.
So you need to be really nuanced to know that.
So what do those people in that tribe do when a product lets them down?
Well, you never know. They smile. They say positive things, and then you just see that your sales figures go down.
Sounds like an incredible way to live. I mean, this just shows you how detailed and narrow the research sometimes has to be.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to market to those people, you really need to know that you're not going to get negative feedback, and you need to be able to almost read that they're being diplomatic when everybody else would say to you, I'm unhappy with this product.
Yeah, it's so true. Because in that particular region, you do need to do a lot more qualitative stuff, observations and all of that. What is interesting is that the region on the opposite of that, this is the southwest part of Nigeria. The southeast part of Nigeria, they are very direct. If they don't like something, you know, they
straight
tell
away.
You they're very, you know, they're not as diplomatic as the others. So imagine having to test products and launch products across those regions. You're almost like dealing with two countries.
Everybody always talks about how Africa is the largest opportunity as a marketplace for international brands, for consumer goods, and so on. But very few people have done the research. So your book must be quite seminal in this respect. I remember reading years ago, this must be 10 years or more ago, I read Chika Onyani's Capitalist Nigger, which was a fascinating book. It kind of talked about how African attitudes to consumerism were originally discovered to be very different to the ideas around consumerism anywhere else.
Yeah.
But that's now almost old in terms of, well, it's very old in terms of the kind of qualitative research that he would have done. But I'm interested in what's changing, because if you look at Nigeria, South Africa, and Kenya, and you refer to those three countries quite often in your book, there are, first of all, very different patterns between the three.
Mm.
But they've also, over the last 10 years, so much has changed.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, I think that, if I may reframe your question a bit, it's,
sure.
I'd expand it by saying what has changed and what has remained the same.
Okay.
You know, what has changed is, obviously, we've adopted technology at a rate that has, you know, startled the world. I mean, 10 years ago, there were landlines in Nigeria. Today, there is zero landlines anywhere.
Right.
And the average Nigerian carries 2 mobile phones all the time. You know, so, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I've got 2 in my pocket. You know, you have to have 2 mobile phones all the time. That has happened within 10 years. And you've seen young people get very social, even old people. My mom has been chasing me for 6 months to add her on Facebook, which I am not going to do that because I know what will happen, you know.
Yeah, no, she's going to spy on you, everything you do.
But what has remained the same is that beneath all of that, there's certain core elements of our culture that have stayed the same, that hasn't shifted. The Economist magazine conducted some survey across countries recently, mm-hmm. and they were trying to measure cultural flexibility among youths, and they basically targeted 18 to 20-year-olds who were very active on social media. And they found that 18 to 20-year-olds in Nigeria were the most culturally inflexible youths in the world.
Most culturally flexible?
Inflexible.
Oh, inflexible.
Inflexible, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, in other words, these are not people who want to change the way that they behave, the way they speak, the way that their traditions have...
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's amazing. I mean, you
is
have
that
this,
a bad thing?
You have these 18 to 20-year-old people saying that it is wrong to have a child before marriage.
Hmm.
Very odd, but they're still the most active on the continent.
Isn't that interesting? Because I mean, Nigeria is one of the most connected countries in Africa, and again, they're exposed to the international world, like, you know, the Gambia or not, for example, or, you know, the Democratic Republic of Congo. But they're inflexible culturally.
Yeah, it was shocking. When I read the report and saw the charts, I was quite surprised. And that tells you that there's what is called slow culture and fast culture. You know, the slow culture is about the fundamentals that make us who we are. Those take generations to shift. Fast culture is about technology, how we dress, clothes we wear. I mean, 10 years ago, I'd come into this studio wearing a tie and all of that. Today, I'm not doing that, obviously. But there's still some very deep-rooted cultural values that I don't shift away from. And so many other people don't, because those things are held together by cultural pillars. That's difficult to move a bit, you know. So
you mentioned technology. Has that changed the way that are people buying differently? Are they using technology to help them research stuff before they buy it, to make choices? Are they more particular about what they buy? Because we have had a flood into our markets all over Africa of cheap, nasty goods as well.
Mm.
I mean, as much as there are expensive, well-known international brands, there are also a lot of cheap Fong Kong knockoffs that come in. And it used to be that we were the place that people dumped all that crap.
Yeah. So, you know, it's weird. Looking at the way people buy, it's kind of interesting that people almost always buy now based on the way they've always bought stuff. So we've seen that in Nigeria, that influencer marketing is incredibly on the high rise. And there are a lot of influencers and social media personalities that have built huge businesses and is thriving. And what you find that's driving that, it's actually the cultural value of needing endorsement from a community. So I will buy something because people in my community or my friends say that this is good, or someone that I respect say that this is good. Now, if you go to the West, you find that people will do a lot of research. They will read reviews and compare. Mm. Nobody reads reviews. We have a joke in Nigeria.
If I said to you, I'm your friend in Nigeria, to you that you need to buy this thing, you'd take my word for it.
I'll take your word for it. Or if I saw a product on Instagram, I said, this is nice. I said, who's following this person? Oh, Cliff is. Okay, that means.
So you were saying there was a joke in Nigeria?
So there's a joke in Nigeria that Nigerians don't read terms and conditions. We just agree.
It's a joke here too. We don't. Nobody reads those things.
The fine print. No, yeah. We don't.
You just ask your friend, does this work? He says, yeah, okay, fine. Yeah.
All right. So what about Kenya? Because they've gone through ups and downs. There was this very, very hopeful period where people were saying this is the Silicon Savannah.
Yeah.
This is the place where in Africa technology is going to take a giant leap forward. We had things like M-Pesa, which was a world first. And then it sort of went quiet for a while, and now they're struggling a bit in Kenya.
Well, I think the Kenya's first, the M-Pesa thing took off largely, stuff like that, financial inclusion, took off largely because their government, you know, adjusted their financial regulation to allow telcos to carry financial licenses. This is something that hasn't been done in most other African countries, which is why that particular product hasn't taken off. But if you look at the Kenyans, they're one of the most optimistic people on the planet. You know, they, in spite of everything that is going on, I've never met a sad Kenyan. You know, they're just happy. They always believe that things are going to be better, things will move forward, and that's so on and so forth. And I'm like, okay, it's not moving forward, but you know, they share that similarity with Nigerians as well. We're incredibly hopeful people. We have a saying in Pidgin, we say it go better, which is just Pidgin for it will be, you know, tomorrow will be better. I mean, my 77 now, when my dad was 72, 5 years ago, he went to the UK and came back and said to me, Feye, I've seen the world, now I would like to plan my life. I'm like, what are you talking about? You are 72. you can't plan your life. But you know, to him, it was, oh, this is something better is out there. Now I can have some aspirations. And I'm looking at this man, you are 72. Why? What are you thinking about? But that's the spirit of the average Nigerian. The Kenyans also have that same spirit. What it gives them is huge resilience. You know, which can have good and bad.
No, I prefer that to what is the overwhelming feeling in South Africa, which is not like that. Mm. South Africans are not optimistic. They're not seeking opportunities like people in Nigeria and Kenya do. And I often draw this contrast because South Africans get, I think, a lot of deserved criticism from the rest of the continent for thinking that they're better and thinking that, you know, we're the leading country in Africa. And we know already that our market is lagging behind Nigeria's now in terms of, and certainly with growth, there are a number of African countries outperforming us. But South Africa is not like that. In your research, does that also show that South Africa is changing as a market?
So I think part of what's driving that is that you find that South Africa is when you think of sub-Saharan African culture, South Africa actually doesn't fall into that, because South Africa is composed of two cultures. You have the Anglo-Dutch culture, which is a very Western culture by orientation. It's individualistic, it's slightly on the pessimistic side because it's based on numbers and projections and all of that. And then you have the African Ubuntu culture, which is more community-based and so on. And when you combine those two cultures in a country that has the level of infrastructural development that is here, it's difficult for you to begin to have national sentiments like optimism and so on and so forth. And you also find that the culture is very quantitative, not qualitative. So yesterday I was with a friend. I was supposed to have an event at Impelo yesterday evening, and then I got a text that the event had been cancelled because it was power outage. So I laughed and I told my friends in Nigeria, I said, well, I was, since 2016 I've been experiencing power outages in South Africa. I said, just by generating sets. So I told him, I said, it's because it's a quantitative culture. Somebody is sitting somewhere and is waiting for it to get to 35% incidence, and then they'll do something. I said, but in Nigeria, it's qualitative. It happens once, twice. We have a proverb that says that if a tree is going to poke your eye from a distance, you dodge it before it happens. So I said, by now, we'd have generating sets everywhere and we'll move on. And you see that... That yeah. cultural contrast translating into how things are done.
And a lot of people in our country, because of this, maybe you're absolutely hitting the nail on the head here. I mean, I don't doubt it for a second if you've done the research. But maybe we also sit on our hands a lot and expect things to be done for us. Where in places like Nigeria and Kenya, if you don't do it yourself, it doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, in Nigeria, we consider ourselves to be our own local government. Because nothing happens, you know.
Nothing.
I mean,
can't rely on
the house.
That
I've got.
Sounds so nice.
It's not nice in reality. It's expensive.
That sounds so freeing.
But you have to look to
it
yourself.
Yeah.
You have to look to. I mean, in my house, I've got inverter. I've got a generating set because most of the time, like every Nigerian, you have to generate your own power. You have to
water.
Do a lot of things. Water. You do the same thing
right.
for yourself, and all of that, which is a bit of a contradiction, because it's a country that the locus of control is external. There's a lot of reliance on community. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to certain things, you provide for yourself. If you flip that to a country like South Africa that has higher internal locus of control, you also find a paradox of, in spite of that, some things are not, people are not doing some things for themselves. So there's a nice tension in there.
Well, I'm fascinated. I mean, the reason you call it the villager is because that's the mindset of the average African consumer, according to your research. So just explain to us what it means to be a villager.
So, you know, being a villager means it's from the idea that almost everyone leaves the rural area and comes to the cities. And if you look at the layout of Africa, it's not like the West, where every state or city is developed enough for someone to stay where they are. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for economic prosperity, you've got to move. However, when you move, what then happens is you're carrying with you the dreams of everyone in the village, because remember, it's a community-based system. Mm-hmm. And as such, in order for you to retain your identity in the city, you have to keep some of the cultural components that make up who you are in the village. And so I say that the African consumer is a villager, and that the village is not a physical place. It's a psychological construct that's got eight components, which I articulate in detail in the book. And that even though the man is in the city, is pursuing economic prosperity, what drives how he engages internally and what he consumes and the things he does, the products he uses, and so on and so forth, is actually coming from values that are rooted in the village.
That makes a lot of sense, but there are obviously positives and negatives to that.
True.
The negative, the obvious thing to concern anybody if you find yourself trapped in this situation, is that it creates some internal conflict.
It does.
Like, you're removed from the village, but you're still required to be in it. It's almost like you're expected to be everything.
Yeah, it does. But you know, it's kind of easy to live with, because the community is organized in a way that ensures that you live that way. So, for instance, I talk about, you know, things like community affirmation, community sanctions. There's some things that you just can't do. So, for instance, in most parts of Africa, at least in Nigeria, Kenya, and all of that, if you have a child, you can't name your child. It has to be named by the larger community, your parents, aunties, and so on and so forth. Well, you can go and live in the city all you want. The day your wife delivers a baby, your mom is going to show up, your dad will follow the, you know, and they'll come with names. So you simply can't do it. You see what I mean? Mm. So because those structures are there, it sort of makes it easy to do. And also because it's when you're in the city, everyone else around you is also a villager. They also have their own cultural values that they are projecting within the city. So it's sort of like a weird self-reinforcing system. Now, the other side to it is, in a world that is getting increasingly globalized, and the world is getting smaller, and, you know, what then happens is that people begin to look for identity, because everything is the same. You know, I get bored on social media sometimes, because once people take a picture, the same posture in the picture, everybody does it.
Yeah.
Everybody uses the same filter. So people are looking for differences. And what's happening is that people are then going back to their cultural identity to find out what makes them different in a world that is very, very globalized, you know.
Was there anything in your research that really surprised you as much as, say, the situation with culture in Nigeria, where it's the least flexible? Was there other stuff that surprised you that you weren't expecting?
So I was surprised by the, you know, one of the eight components I talk about is the value of the enemy. And I talk about the fact that that the African is motivated by an enemy. His psychology of success must include an enemy. And initially, when I started researching this, I first began to notice it in music, and found out that all the successful musicians always had what I called an anti-hater track on their albums, and that was like the club banger and all of that. But as I began to research this, I was surprised to come across Western research that actually confirmed that and said that Maslow's hierarchy of human needs does not apply to Africa. It's a Western construct, and that the whole idea of pursuing self-actualization is a Western thing, and that cultures like Africa and Asia, people aren't pursuing self-actualization. They're actually pursuing the goal of fulfilling the role that the community has assigned to them. So I was quite struck by that. I didn't believe that I would find research that supported that, particularly
this
from
thing,
the West.
This thing about needing an enemy.
Yes.
I mean, that's incredible, because that will inform a lot of the behavior.
Yeah, it does.
If you need an enemy in order to, and if you need to vanquish that enemy in order to succeed,
yeah,
then a lot of people are battling demons that we need to acknowledge.
The concept of enemy for the African is not necessarily an antagonist. This is not Al Qaeda type of
no, but it's winning. It's about
it's winning.
Winning is predicated upon you beating someone else.
Yeah, that enemy is the person that says that
you
stands
win.
Yeah, that says you won't win, and that's the person you need to. So the psychology of success is kind of like a triangle. On one hand is your own individual aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand is what the community expects you to become. And then, you know, the third leg of it is proving the enemy wrong, that you can do this. And yesterday, I went 2 days ago, I went to barb my hair somewhere in Joburg. And wonderful Baba, Congolese guy, name is Sammy. And you know, Babas give you good stories and all of that. Tells me this incredible story of his life, how he was impacted by a Nigerian, a South African, and an American, and all of that. Nice story. And at the end, he says to me, he said, you know, yo, brah, you know, if you want to achieve something in life, there's always an enemy there. I'm like, yeah, I know. I wrote a chapter on it in my book. And I was so struck by that this is a Congolese guy. He's been in South Africa for 11 years. He's been influenced by multiple people, but he's there barbing in a salon, and he has this mindset that there's an enemy I need to prove wrong.
Wow.
Even though I'm just a barber.
That can be very motivating, but it can also be a little disempowering, I would imagine, because sometimes there aren't people actively conspiring against you, and if you don't have them and you have that mindset, you need to create them.
Yeah, I mean, it can go to that extent, to be honest, but almost always there is, because if you look at the group dynamics of the African setting and the fact that we're very collectivist, almost always, if you have aspirations, you share that within the context of a group. And there will always be someone there who has a different point of view, what we will call the devil's advocate. Well, that person may ultimately actually, in your mind, be labeled as an enemy, because you look forward to the day you come back successful at that thing that the person said you couldn't be, and you let them know that you're successful.
It can motivate you.
It can motivate you, yeah. It can motivate you.
Is this collectivism at odds with capitalism?
I think it is. It's an interesting question for you to ask, because it's something I've been thinking about, even though I didn't touch on it in the book. I think it is, because capitalism is strongly rooted in an individualistic culture.
Mm.
And you can see that Africa as a whole is struggling with capitalism. You know, in businesses that have gone very, very capitalist, we've seen struggles with succession planning. We've seen struggles with multi-generational businesses and all of that. And I would almost endeavor to argue that somehow Africa needs to find a business model or a business philosophy that sits well within the collectivist culture that makes us who we are, and that perhaps will offer a way forward.
If that's the case, then there's obviously a deeper question that can be asked here is about individual agency.
Mm.
I mean, the ability for someone you mentioned earlier to be able to choose not to take on the role that their village has assigned to them.
Yeah.
That they don't necessarily have to choose to be what their community tells them to be.
Yeah.
It almost feels like that goes against, you know, the Enlightenment principles of individual liberty and agency.
Well, so
is that a conflict?
There's a conflict, but there's a nice resolution to it. If you do exercise agency, which you can, and say, okay, I don't want to be whatever my community wants me to be, well, you have to come back successful. That's the balance.
And if you don't succeed, the community will eat you up.
Yeah, that's
so it's good. Almost as if there's a higher price to pay.
Yeah.
For Africans.
Yeah.
If you fail.
Yeah.
And the price is that you not only will fail in the market, but you will fail with your community.
Yeah. You know,
that seems really unfair.
Well, you know, most collectivist cultures are shame-based cultures.
Jesus, that's awful.
You know, individualistic cultures are guilt-based, and you know, guilt is
both are awful. But I mean, shame-based. Shame-based means you have to walk down the street in your own town and have people speaking ill of you.
Yeah, I mean, and you see, it's guilt,
just write off if you have no conscience.
Well, you know, the thing with shame-based cultures is one of the benefits of it is it does create social regulation. Because the avoidance of shame can be a very strong motivation in itself. You don't, you know, you find entrepreneurs all over the place. I see them in Nigeria who wanted to do something else, but couldn't do it or follow their dream or whatever. They know they have to succeed, you know.
You mentioned the price of failure being so high. But the benefits of success are tremendous as well.
Yes.
So you have this much more extenuated and differentiated situation. So if you fail and then you end up being shamed and your community will reject you very often and say, well, we told you so.
Yeah.
And those enemies, in inverted commas, will stand on you and make you feel small.
Yeah.
But the value of success is enormous because it is. There's this attribution of almost superpower.
Yeah, I mean, I touched on this briefly in the book, but my own personal story almost follows that exactly. You know, I was supposed to be a medical doctor, was in medical school for 4 years. You know, my dad was very proud. And then, you know, I didn't pass the exams and I had to leave. And the man was upset. He didn't speak to me for 4 years, was just mad all over the place. You know, and then I told him I was going to read psychology. He said, so you are going to be talking to mad people. And, you know, so you can imagine this disaster. My mom was crying every day. Just say, you were supposed to be a medical doctor, great professional. You'll be talking to mad people. And I had to explain to her, no, it's not talking to mad people. I said, no, you know. And then fast forward years later, became the CEO of the leading ad agency in the country, drives it, you know, had a Mercedes Benz and all of that. You know, you can imagine the emotion taking, going home with the car. We do this thing in Nigeria where you have to bless your car when you buy it and all of that, you know. And the kind of prayers my parents were saying when they were blessing the car was kind of gratifying because, you know, to them it was. And, you know, my dad actually said, well, all those enemies that said you couldn't succeed, now they can see that you've succeeded. So you see that dynamic.
Did you say to your dad, yeah, you were once an enemy when you said that I was going to work with mad people?
That would have been a very tough conversation.
Faye, this is a really, really interesting book. I would encourage anybody who says that they are, you know, you hear about all these companies all over the world that are interested in understanding the African market, how they can make an impact, how they can start selling their products, how they can introduce themselves to African consumers. I think this is going to be required reading for those people. This should be a textbook in economy, lectures in economics at university. It's terrific. The Villager is what it's called, How Africans Consume Brands. Faye Olubudan, I appreciate you coming to speak to us this morning.
Thank you very much, Cliff.
And I hope we'll see you again soon. You spend a lot of time in South Africa?
I go back and forth, so yeah.
Yeah. That's another thing, huh? You have to constantly be moving in Africa. You can't ever settle down and just do nothing.
So true. So true.
Man, this is very cool. Yeah. I appreciate you coming in to speak to us.
Thank you very
much.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Pleasure. Yes. There we go. You can get the book, The Villager, How Africans Consume Brands. It's very, very interesting. I breezed through it during the last 3 or 4 days and found it to be just, you know, very seminal. It's helped me to understand kind of how a lot of things that I wasn't making sense of, and you just heard from Faye, things like, you know, this idea of community, the idea of collectivist thinking, the idea of if this is competitive with and in conflict with capitalism, how do you deal with a marketplace that is essentially based on, you know, trade, supply and demand, which is capitalism? And it's complicated because sometimes you end up trying to square the circle or trying to contort yourself into the most awkward and uncomfortable positions in order to accommodate ideas that are actually opposed. They're polar opposites.
This is CliffCentral.com.